It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 367 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. I really appreciate you listening. This week is the return of Terrence Grace, who has a wonderful Kickstarter going on right now. And it's for a book called The Crossroads, and it's described as an H.P. Lovecraft-inspired horror board book. We talk about H.P. Lovecraft and what a board book is as well, so we do a lot of discussion about how the book came to be, about Lovecraft himself, as well as other things that are really interesting about the book. I've supported it, as I mentioned during the interview, and I encourage you to go and do it too. It's under The Crossroads, and I think that's usually easy to figure out. He's very close to his goal as of this episode, so it would be great if you would get out there after you listen to his interview and support him. Word of warning, every once in a while, Skype likes to have fun, and it did something unusual I've never seen before. When Terrence would speak, it often had like an echo coming on, and it gives him the appearance of somebody like who's talking in the background of him, and I did my best to take out all as much of that as I could, but you may hear a little bit, and if you need to turn up the volume, that's fine, because I think Terrence has a lot of good things to say, so I want to be sure you get to listen. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show.
Hello. I'm Terrence Grace, writer and co-creator of The Crossroads. I'd like to introduce you to a surreal tale, an imaginary journey back in time to what might have influenced one of the world's most influential creators of horror. This story originated in the recently published anthology, Cthulhu is Hard to Spell. I decided the artwork needed a bit of breathing room, and so Silvio and I redesigned the layouts and expanded the story to 24 pages. What's unique about this edition is that I'm going to publish it in a lay-flat board book. Mind you, not your ordinary children's book. Something a bit larger and scarier. So why don't you meet me down at the crossroads? There's someone there I'd like to introduce you to.
It's great to welcome back to the podcast Terrence Grace, the creator of The Locksmith, and who now has a nice Kickstarter going. And it's for a book called The Crossroads. How are you doing today?
Hey, Wayne. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on
Terrence, again. Always good to talk with you. Well, why don't we just real quick, The Locksmith. Has that concluded now? Everything's done with that?
No. The fourth and final issue, there was a bit of delay because Silvio DB, the artist that I've been working with, had a herniated disc that took him out of commission for, gosh, about six months. And so all plans just had to be put aside. He had some surgery, and now he's back on the drawing board again. And so we're starting up. So I'm hopeful, probably in a couple of months, the fourth and final issue will be ready to go.
Cool, because I'd like to see that, because I've enjoyed the series. So I'm anxious to see how it goes. I wondered when I, because I hadn't seen the end of it, so I was wondering what happened. So. Okay, well, that's good. Yeah. Well, you know, hey, real life gets in the way of comics, as I always like to say. And you can't do it when you're laying on your back with pain all over. Boy, that drawing is not on you. You might be able to write if you could speak into a microphone or something, but you couldn't. Drawing is going to be very difficult. Well, why don't we move on to The Crossroads then? We were talking just a little bit before we started to record about how this book got started, and there's several interesting and unusual things about it. Why don't you go ahead and talk about, because this it's called a board book, which makes the size a little different. Why don't we start off talking about that?
Well, board book, it's just like those children's books that you might see with very thick pages. The books tend to lay flat, so your orientation tends to be with two pages open at once. Mm-hmm. And it's definitely an unusual choice, especially because children's board books tend to be square format. But this, The Crossroads, is a landscape format. So it's essentially comic book size, but landscape. Mm-hmm. And let me go back to the very beginning. Last year, I was asked to contribute a story to a Lovecraft anthology called Cthulhu Is Hard to Spell. And it's also hard to spell sometimes. And so... this originated in that anthology, but in the anthology, it's just a six-page story. And Silvio actually contacted me because of this debilitating back thing he was going through. And he was really unable to produce any work in 2018. And he was going to the Brazilian Comic Con, but needed some new work. And so he asked me what I thought about actually expanding The Crossroads into a standard comic 24-pager single issue. So I said, yeah, sure. And so I we talked about laying it out differently, and I worked with his translator to translate it into Portuguese. And so that started. And essentially because of the delay of The Locksmith, I decided to do the same thing here. And I had an idea to make this something, you know, something very special, much more unique, like a one-of-a-kind item, and turn it into this board book, something, you know, kind of like an object de art that you might have on your coffee table.
Because you gave me a PDF to look at, which is in the board book format. And I do have to say it's much more striking in that format. When I actually read the other version first, and then I sat down and read that, and I was really much more taken in by the board book format. I do have to say, it really just, you know, because you've got the facing pages like that wide, you get a much more cinematic feel as you're reading the book, and I really liked it. I thought, you know, it's one of those books that transport you somewhere. You know, you're sitting looking at it, and all of a sudden you're not sitting looking at a computer screen or something. You're in the book, watching these things happen. And it's really well done. I do have to say, I really love it. So as we're recording this, the Kickstarter's underway. And why don't you tell people when it's going to conclude?
It finishes up in about 2 weeks on February 14th. And we are currently, I think, hovering around 65% funded. So we had a great surge right out of the first 3 days. And it's kind of settled into that mid-campaign Kickstarter malaise that always seems to happen. And I think it's been slow but steady. It's going to be close, but I think we can pull it out.
Well, you sent around also a Word file that's called a background story, and it tells the stuff about how this came a lot more in detail. And one of the things you said in there is you hoped that people wouldn't get the digital version, but they go for the book, the hardcover book, because of the layout and the experience. I think that's – so I immediately went in because I had requested a digital. I went in and upgraded it to the book because I wanted to be sure to get that. So
yeah, I think it really does make a difference. I mean, you know, like what we were talking about earlier, especially people who get so many comics every month, it's hard to get the physical versions. But this, I do hope people opt in for it because, as you said, it is – a much more cinematic experience that I don't think you're going to get on a tablet.
I read the page by page version of it, and it just didn't feel as massive as this one does. So I really like the way that it's done. So I really liked it. Now, well, one of the things you sent me was this background story that has a lot of information that I guess is not going to be in the hardcover. At least I didn't see it there. Why don't you talk a little bit about that? Because it delves into your connection to where Lovecraft lived and stuff like that, where he wrote. Why don't you talk about how you were there at a point, according to this?
Sure. For a period of about most of my life, I lived in New York City, and I live in L.A. now. But for about 10 years while I was in New York, beginning around 1990, I lived in this quaint little neighborhood called Brooklyn Heights. And Brooklyn Heights is very famous for its promenade that looks directly across the river at Wall Street, downtown Manhattan. And for some reason, it was always a haven for writers. In fact, when I lived there, Norman Mailer was living just around the corner from me. I lived on Montague Street, and he lived about a block and a half away on Columbia Heights. And, I used to see this old geezer shuffling down Montague, and he'd always go over to a newsstand, which I don't think is there anymore. But he'd just lean over the stoop and read the headlines. But there were a lot of many other writers, Arthur Miller, W.H. Auden, W.E.B. Du Bois, Carson McCullers. And at the time, I did not know this, but later on I found out that H.P. Lovecraft also lived in Brooklyn Heights. And he lived at 169 Clinton Street, which about three blocks from where I lived. Today, it's a beautiful brownstone, really nice place. But I imagine at the time of when my story takes place, The Crossroads, which is 1925, it was a very different neighborhood. And he, from what I've read about him, really did not like living there, particularly its proximity to Red Hook, which was about a half mile south of Brooklyn Heights. But Red Hook was very much a shanty town back then. And my step into this story about him was indeed that. And, you know, he was not known. We do know now that he was pretty much a bigot, a racist, and had a hard time with the immigrant population there in Brooklyn. And so I thought, well, you know, that's interesting, because he was actually married to Sonia Green for a couple of years, and she was his benefactor. And in fact, after they separated, she continued to support him with a monthly allowance. But he had held some anti-Semitic views, but she was Jewish. So there was this odd dichotomy that really drew me into my story. And I just thought that this inner turmoil that he must have been going through, you know, having these extreme ideas about a certain population, probably infused his work about monsters and horror. And so that's where my story really lies. It's this kind of internal malignancy that I like to call it, that physicalizes and transforms Lovecraft.
Now, one of the things you mentioned in the background story is the fact that you weren't a Lovecraft aficionado before. And then you started doing research on it, and then you came to this thing, and that kind of brought you into who he is. Did it make you a fan?
I can't say I've read very much. Okay. I've read this, particularly the work that he was writing near to that time where my story takes place, because I didn't want to get become influenced by his style of writing. And so I was really much more interested in looking at him as a person and his relationship with Sonia. But there was The Horror at Red Hook is something I immediately read to give a little bit of background of what must have been going through his head at the time.
Now, my understanding is you draw the inside covers as well as put the quotes in there. It's like a black and white thing, and it's got the tentacles and stuff going around. Is it okay for me to read the quotes that you've got in there?
Sure.
The first one, it says, "It is in dreams that I have known the real clutch of stark, hideous, maddening, paralyzing fear." And then the second one reads, "It is good to be a cynic. It is better to be a contented cat. And it is best not to exist at all." You know, wow, that's pretty powerful stuff. You know?
Very intense, but yeah.
Do you know where those quotes come from, just off the top of your head?
I can't tell you off the top, but they were in a couple of essays that he wrote, which are available. You can Google around, and people have put them up on the internet.
Because it's just that wow, it sets the stage really for the story real well. It's so interesting. Now, why don't you, of course, we don't want to spoil much here. We want to talk about the story, about, you call it, I'm trying to remember, it's a Robert Johnson moment?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's where the title comes from, The Crossroads. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the old myth that Robert Johnson, the blues player, learned how to play the way he played by selling his soul down at the crossroads to the devil.
Right. Wow.
So this is kind of... I like to say this is Lovecraft's Robert Johnson moment as well. Although he's not really selling his soul to the devil, he has a meeting with Yog-Sothoth, which is one of his gods from the Lovecraft mythos.
Because when you were doing the stuff for that one anthology, you had to have one of the gods in there, and that was the one that you chose for that.
Yes.
Well, tell me, I mean, was it a challenge to expand it out from, you know, it was only 6 pages you were saying to start, and now it's 24 pages, you got 4 times as large. Was it a challenge to do that, or were there parts of the story you wished you could have gotten to before, and now you got a chance to meet those things? How did that work?
Well, fortunately, we had high-resolution files of the original artwork, and Silvio went back and re-inked some of the panels, also worked in a bit of ink wash, which wasn't in the original, because the original anthology version is in color. But essentially what changes dramatically is the design and layout, and it really opens up the story and allows for the text, which in some parts is very dense, to live on its own, as well as the artwork and the amazing artwork. It just breathes.
Is the likeness to Lovecraft pretty accurate? I mean, is that what he looked like pretty much, or is this...
Certainly the way... I think Silvio got him. I mean, in some panels, it's a little bit different. Certainly the cover art. I think he definitely nailed him. I mean, I'm always struck when I see photographs of him, what a buttoned-up, tight-lipped guy he was. I mean, he definitely was holding on to a lot of internal conflict.
Because, you know what, the tough thing about this book is not to spoil it, because, you know, right away you get into the story and things start to happen, and they're important as to who Lovecraft is, shall we say. I can't say it. There's something that I think is going to spoil the book, and I hate for people to be spoiled. They really need to read this and catch it and the whole thing. But let's just say Lovecraft looks perfectly normal at one point, and something interesting or different starts to happen. And that progresses... And it doesn't seem that he's terribly aware of it, except at certain points he is. You know, obviously things are happening and he does. And it really, you talk about like a transformation, it really makes a transformation into his writing, apparently, and who he is and how he thinks of stuff. And, you know, you mentioned the wife. The wife actually plays a part a little in the story, which I found interesting, too.
Mm-hmm.
So I really liked it because, you know, the thing about, I'm a sort of a writer. I'm not like you. I don't write stories in that sense. I write reviews and I write other things. I analyze other people's writing and stuff like that. But to me, I mean, I'm always fascinated by the creative process and how people write. Where do you get ideas? How do things come together? How do you tell the story? How do you choose what it is you do? What is it about the project that makes you go a certain way? Like, for example, we haven't talked about it, but this is mostly black and white in there, as opposed to, you mentioned that he had changed the images from color to black and white. Was black and white more to fit the story, do you think?
You know, when we first started talking about this expanded version, he said he wanted to do it in black and white, and I was like, but I really love the color. But then I thought more and more about it, and there is kind of let's say a David Lynchian quality to that black and white. It also lends itself to that time, 1925, is when the story takes place. So I turned it around at the end, or I should say Silvio turned me around, and now I think it really does work great as black and white. And I think, you know, even the interesting thing about releasing it as a board book is people are free to color it themselves if they want to.
Oh, I wouldn't want to touch this with color. I'd ruin it for sure. It wouldn't look nearly as good when I get done with it because it really is very – it's haunting is the word I kept thinking as I read the book. You know, what's interesting, too, is you have like a – your book ends on the story. There's a letter that Lovecraft wrote. Did you write that letter, or was that an actual letter that he wrote to Sonya?
No, that's all my stuff, writing. Okay. Yeah, and – you mentioned before where, you know, how does the story begin? Where do you get the original idea? Well, I really had no clue what to write about Lovecraft or any of the gods, not being an aficionado. But I had this poem that I had written several years ago that was just sitting around in one folder on my computer. And I pulled it out and I said, you know what, this isn't Lovecraft writing, but this is potentially one of the gods speaking through him. And so that's how the whole story began, is with this kind of floral poetry that runs as a thread all the way through. And we assume through the story that he is writing this in the letter to his wife, and he's recalling this nightmare he had. But we're also not quite sure if indeed the letter is within the nightmare. It's, you know, it operates on different levels.
Now, one of the things I have to say, and I think that Silvio did a great job on this, when it starts out at the beginning, Lovecraft's expression is one way. And when it gets after the moment, his expression is very different. And he seems a lot more animated in how he's doing things. Is that what you kind of felt happened to him when this kind of stuff happened? Did it actually like set him free on some levels?
Yeah, I mentioned before this internal malignancy that physicalizes, and yeah, it is a freeing moment, and that is very much what this story is. It's also a metaphor for writer's block. And so, yeah, the tight-lipped, buttoned-up guy slowly is transformed into this monstrous creature. We can say that much.
Well, I don't want to spoil stuff, but let's just say his appearance, the clothes he wears doesn't seem to change, but he changes, which I thought was really well shown in the artwork. The artwork really made that happen. You know, it's almost, well, see, I can't say it because I want people to read it. It's really just amazing how he does that, and it just, you know, you get to see what a different person he is by that time. So it's really, really well done. I congratulate him on that, and I'm sure that's what you intended as well, as far as who he was when this story comes to an end. Now, this is before he's written all the other stuff that people really enjoy today.
Yeah, this was. I mean, he was really an unknown, struggling, not able to make any money. I mean, he would have a few short stories published in the pulps, but he was not famous at all, and. You know, really the whole mythos, and in particular Yog-Sothoth, this particular god was created, within a year or so after that time that he lived in Brooklyn Heights.
Interesting, because it's really a fascinating story in a sense, because there are so many people that enjoy Lovecraft. I have never been one of those that has really understood all this, because I can never pronounce Cthulhu. It's only recently that I've actually figured it out, and so for me, all this stuff I don't understand. Well, I appreciate supernatural things, but I'm always kind of, I don't like stuff that say takes people down a darker path. So to me, Lovecraft has always been unappealing in that way, because a lot of the times that's where he goes. He's taking people downhill, just as apparently, well, let's just say he goes somewhere down that same route in this book. And so for me, I mean, do you understand the appeal of Lovecraft as far as, you know, because there are people in horror that just worship, you know, the books that he's written and the stories that he's told?
Well, he has had an enormous influence on, I would make a direct line between him and H.R. Giger, for example. And I do think Giger and then the whole alien mythology that came from his drawings. I think that's my theory, that the younger people today really latched on to Lovecraft through that. But, you know, just in regards to filmmakers, I think early David Cronenberg is very much influenced by Lovecraft. Stephen King has even mentioned him as one of the great writers of horror. And I think perhaps also what he speaks to is this internal conflict that he was able to physicalize it very much as the Crossroads does. But his own stories, I think, operate on that level. And there's a lot of people that will connect to that internal nightmarish quality of fear at night, you know, that he very much, you know, touches on in a fantastic way.
Because that quote about how it's better not to have existed at all is, you know, that's quite a...
very existential, it's his Nietzschean moment there.
I mean, wow. I mean, you know, because, you know, I understand, you know, there used to be a philosophy in the 1800s where the fatted calf, humans were best if they were just fatted calves, that they didn't have to think or anything. They just got lots of food and sat around all day, they'd be happy. But I don't think that's true. There might be some people that's true, but not now. And he talks about the contented cat in there too, which brought that back to my mind about that kind of stuff. Because he's not the contented cat in any way. You know, this shows what, you know, what kind of things were going around in his head, and the kind of things that he was going to go on and do were really amazing stuff. I think the book really catches that too. I think it really captures how, you know, how he would move forward and become the H.P. Lovecraft that people know. Did you know any more about his history? I mean, how long did he live?
He died quite young. Without quickly Googling it, I want to say he was in his 40s when he died. I could be wrong with that, but he was young. I mean, he, you know, was suffering. I imagine he was one of these hypochondriacs, constantly ill, not eating right, disturbed on so many levels.
That's so interesting because, you know, but it's interesting that he didn't know the influence he would have afterwards. You know, he's one of those people that, you know, after their death suddenly becomes a big name and big star and has a lot of influence that they probably, during their lives, didn't understand. And I always feel bad for that because, you know, they miss out on all the people. I always feel like when somebody is popular now, we should be recognizing them. We should be doing things to let them know how much we appreciate their work. But, you know, it doesn't sound like Lovecraft knew that there was going to be people generations afterwards that were going to really enjoy his stuff.
Probably not, although he did create this Lovecraftian mythos that he left open for interpretation for other creators to take on and work within. And so in that sense, it was his way of keeping the work alive.
Wow. You know, this would make a great little movie. I could see this, the way that you guys have scoped it out and the artwork and stuff, just would make a wonderful little black and white movie someplace. I think it would scare people the heck out. I'm glad I got to read this before I went to sleep at night. Because, man, it really is haunting. It really is, you know, it's that kind of story that you kind of worry about. See, there's little things that happen in the end. I don't want to spoil it, but let's just say there's a picture of what looks to be tentacles. And it looks like some of those are not necessarily staying on the page, shall we say. And right away, I was a little aghast. that maybe Lovecraft's work influences people on a level that even they aren't aware of. And that's the kind of thing that you're implying here with this.
Yeah, that the writing is alive, yeah.
Just amazing. I was just... This would make such a great little movie. This would be ideal.
I thought of the same thing. Yeah, I would love it. It would be a great little short.
Because I could see going to like a comic book convention, and they always show little movies and stuff like that. And at nighttime, they'll show stuff. And this would just be a perfect Saturday night short to see in there. Oh, man, it would just be ideal. Just be great. So is that the end for the Lovecraft connection that you're doing?
Probably, at this point, yes, probably. I saw this as a one-off, and you know, it's kind of cool that it has a Portuguese version that's being distributed in Brazil, and which that layout is different than the English version here. And then it's part of this anthology as well. Mm-hmm. So, I don't see myself revisiting this at this point.
Interesting. Well, of course, that leads to the next question is, okay, I'm sure this is going to be successful. I mean, I've upped my bid. Maybe if other people hear this, they'll want to bid or up their bid to get the paper copy. What are you working on after this? I'm sure you've got other irons in the fire. Is there anything you can tell us about at this point that you're working on?
Well, as we mentioned before, the final issue of The Locksmith.
Right.
And I say final, but I will say that I do have an idea for perhaps an epilogue that would appear only if it's collected in a hardcover, all four issues. But that's to be determined. And I have a whole library of unproduced screenplays that we'll go to next. I've been working on something called Spanish Moss for a while. I had to put it down last year because of some other work. But I'll probably pick that up again. It's a ghost story that takes place in the Louisiana Bayou. And there's also a script that I was hired to write years and years ago that all the rights have come back to me now. And it's based on a true story about an Indian woman who was working for British special operations executive in German-occupied Paris. And for a period of about 6 months, she was the only communication to Britain from Paris. And a truly amazing story. We've come very close to producing as a movie several times, but so far no luck. But I thought it would make a great graphic novel. So that may happen.
That'd be good because, you know, as somebody like you who's adept at writing both screenplays and graphic novels, you can make that happen and turn it into a good story that people would like to read. And, you know, eventually, sometimes these things go full circle. You know, you put out a graphic novel that gets people's attention and suddenly they want to make a movie about it.
Yes,
that
indeed.
Nice.
That is how The Locksmith started. My manager got some interest from studios, but they all came back and said this, you know, this really feels like a graphic novel. And it was suggested to me that I adapt it into comic format. And so that's how it started. And now it's quite different from the screenplay. I would have to rewrite it if it ever went back to a TV series.
So you wouldn't go back and use the original script. You've made changes that you prefer to this.
Yes. The comic medium allows you to just work on so many different layers, and it completely opened up the story. So it would have to be rewritten.
Interesting, because people think that, you know, that the movies and, like, say, screenplays and stuff are the ultimate version of things, that whatever in there is, there's no more, you know, basically in there, because that's the way the movie goes. But the way you did your graphic novel, you fleshed out apparently some stuff, and it made the story even, you know, broader and more interesting, sounds like.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, in the original screenplay, there was no 17th century B story that is occurring through the comics. So, and that's really made the story that much better and much more exciting.
See, that's that creative process that always fascinates me. You know, you think you've got things the best you can, and then you start to work on it a little bit, and things change. You know, it's really fascinating to me. I'm always interested in that, and I think that's just great. You know, it's great that you can do those kinds of things, because some people are really, once they write a screenplay, they're locked into that screenplay, and the graphic novel, if there is one, is going to have to match that exactly. And that's nice that you were able to flesh it out and put some extra story in there that probably made, you know, enhance the read a little bit. That's great.
Yeah, well, I love the medium. I do have an art background, actually, before my movie background. I went to art school, so I very much appreciate being able to tell a story visually, and especially art on the page has a design element that I just love, and I love to play around with it as much as I can when I do.
Have you written and drawn stuff together?
Well, that's what I'm doing with Spanish Moss. Gotcha. I'm working on that myself. Okay. And it's a completely different process because I'm actually building three-dimensional environments and characters. And in a way, it's like making a movie. I set up each shot, each panel, and then I sketch over what I've done from a three-dimensional graphics program.
Interesting.
So it's a long, tedious process because I'm not that great of a freehand drawer myself. I can work in much more abstract expressions. That's my forte.
Because some people are great at writing, some people are good at artists, some people can do both. I always think of Jeff Lemire. And in his artwork, I don't know if you've ever read any of his stuff. Yeah, he had Sweet Tooth was one. It was about like a mutant kid that had antlers and stuff like that. I've always wondered why.
Oh yes.
Why do mutants always look like, you know, high school, you know, models and stuff like that? And this was a book where that wasn't the case. Now he wrote the story and he also drew it. And I have to say that I don't know if you got to the end of it, the very last couple pages is where things resolve themselves, shall we say. And if I want a good cry, I go to that page, those pages, because that just makes, I just well up with tears and stuff like that. It's just a very well done. And his artwork is not what I would consider really arty stuff. It's kind of craggy the way it does it. But he's still able to communicate emotion and stuff like that through it. So,
well, I have the same reaction to any of Dave McKean's artwork. And especially some of the things he did with Neil Gaiman, where it's not necessarily traditional comic art, but it's, you know, he mixes media, and it's whatever works to tell the story the best. And you know, McKean's work I can just stare at and stare at and look at, you know, what kind of process he went through to create these drawings. It's truly amazing.
Well, that's why I'm with Lemire. I'm just always. I just don't understand how it, you know, because when he writes a story and somebody else draws it, I can't see him drawing it. But then when he draws it, I'm always like, wow, that is just amazing how he does that. You know, now I'm interested to see your stuff. I want to see how you draw because I enjoy your writing tremendously. I'd love to see you using both, you know, parts of the comic medium. It'd be fun to see.
Well, hopefully sometime in, I'm imagining 2020, I will finally have Spanish Moss stuff.
Now, you letter too, right?
Yeah, I do all the lettering, and that's I try to have as much of you know, artistic hand that I can in both The Locksmith and Crossroads, and that's why my relationship with Silvio works so well. Is he allows me, and he just kind of get we have a, you know, a shorthand together, and it just works.
Cool. Well, this is a great book. It's called The Crossroads. Go to Kickstarter. And, you know, when this posts, hopefully we'll be farther along, 65%. But I think this is one of those great books that I'm going to want from my bookshelf. And I'm going to want to keep because it's one of those great things that it's just a story. Sometimes a story doesn't have to be volume after volume after volume to be really good. Sometimes a shorter story has a lot more punch to it. And I think that's where this story comes in. It really hits you hard. And I imagine what those people who really enjoy Lovecraft are going to get a lot more out of it, too, because they're going to understand. It's probably going to help them understand why Lovecraft wrote the way he did and things that happened. So really, really good stuff. So, you know, Terrence, once again, I think you've done some wonderful stuff. And I want this Kickstarter to be successful so that you can go on and do other good things because it's really good stuff. I really enjoy it.
Oh, thank you so much, Wayne. Yeah, I do think we'll get there, but we are going to need a lot of help on this the last couple of weeks. So check it out on Kickstarter.
Sounds good, and we'll do that.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
And that that's it for this episode. Be back next time. I'll have another great interview with an excellent comics creator, something I'm sure you won't want to miss. But until then, keep reading your comics.